Hey there. Welcome to the Women in Our Town podcast, a place for unsilent women to have important conversations. I'm your host, Purva Miller. Let's go. Welcome to the Women in Our Town podcast. I am joined today by Sophie Barron. She is the founder and CEO of The Conversationalist, a Gen Z platform that aims at amplifying Gen Zers' voices and helps them break out of the echo chamber one conversation at a time. Sophie, I am thrilled beyond thrilled to have you here today. It is so amazing because I feel like I have been following The Conversationalist since you guys were babies, and you've grown. It's been amazing to watch your growth. Welcome.
Purva, thank you so much for having me. The feeling is beyond mutual. I feel like I've been following your journey with Women in Our Town since the start. So I'm just so grateful to be here on your podcast.
Thank you. It's amazing. You know, it was funny. I had a thought the other day because we connected for International Women's Day on Clubhouse, and we were talking in a room where I can't remember what it was, the question that you were asked by the moderator, but you said, I don't want to speak for my entire generation. And what that, it kind of reminded me of the first episode of Girls, where Lena Dunham's character, Hannah Horvath, says, I am the voice of my generation. And it kind of, it just, I was like, well, I get it, but her platform is about amplifying voices. And I can't think of anyone, you know, more that embodies an incredible Gen Zer than you.
Thank you so much, Purva. It means so much. I could say the same for you about the millennial generation. And I think for me, I have such an interesting take because I consider myself actually to be a zillennial. Yeah. So I was born 2 weeks before the traditional Gen Z cutoff.
Right.
And so I consider myself to be a bridge. I have this unique perspective into both the millennial generation and Generation Z. So I try not to speak on behalf of an entire generation, but I'm grateful to be in a position to amplify others' voices.
That's amazing. So why don't we start a little bit with you, and why don't you tell us a little bit about your journey and what inspired you to start The Conversationalist?
I would love to. So I'm actually coming to you right now from my childhood bedroom in Wichita, Kansas, where I grew up, and that really connects to where it all began. So for me, growing up in the Midwest, it was a very humbling yet wonderful experience. However, it was challenging at times. Mm-hmm. From such an early age, I quickly identified that I was a lot different than my peers.
Right.
All I wanted when I was younger in middle school and high school was to fit in. I just wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to be a fly on the wall. But no matter how hard I tried, I was immediately labeled as the other. Mm-hmm. I was the only Jewish kid in my entire grade throughout K through 12 education, at one point my entire school. And growing up as the only Jew, it was challenging. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to communicate about my identity and my background, and my classmates, for no fault of their own, didn't understand what it meant to be Jewish. And so this feeling of being the only one, being the token Jew, it led me to feel a lot of shame surrounding who I was. Right. And that shame allowed me to feel like I didn't have a voice. All I wanted was to start speaking up about the things that mattered to me. I knew I wanted to make a difference in the world, but I didn't know how. Mm-hmm. And I think for so much of my life, I thought that I had to wait for someone else's permission to have a voice, to have one.
Right.
So that's where it all began, was really this feeling of voicelessness in my childhood. And so as soon as it was time to go to college, I was running out the door. I followed the yellow brick road, if you will, all the way to the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And as soon as I was on campus, I was so excited. I was like a kid in a candy store, finally seeing all of these people from all walks of life, but also other Jewish kids.
Right.
It was the first time where I realized, hey, it's normal to be Jewish. There are other people out there that are like me. Mm-hmm. And I immediately felt at home.
Right.
And not to go too far into depth, but I had this epiphany at the end of my freshman year at Penn, mm-hmm. where I realized that I had surrounded myself with only Jewish kids on campus.
Right.
And I definitely felt comfortable, right? Birds of a feather flock together.
Right, of course.
But I was walking through campus one beautiful day and was looking at all of the people around me. And I started to realize that I was taking for granted what I had in Wichita mm-hmm. when I actually was surrounding myself with people who challenged me and maybe didn't understand me so well
right.
because it pushed me to understand them.
Right.
So long story short, I was able to understand this idea of the echo chamber and I wanted to do something about it. Mm-hmm. I think there was something about being outside of the Midwest that gave me some agency to start using my voice.
Yeah.
And so that's where it all began. It's a bit of my backstory. And that started, one thing led to another. And mm-hmm. I started a club on my campus. It was called Table Talk.
Yeah.
The whole purpose was to bring people together from different backgrounds to get to know each other, make new friends. And before I knew it, I had spread Table Talk to over 80 college and high school campuses.
Wow.
All with this idea of breaking the echo chamber. I thought this was just my own issue. I was the only person seeing this. It was just on my campus or just my upbringing.
Right.
But I started to realize that this issue persisted almost like a common cold, and it was going to require some sort of impetus, some cultural shift to get people outside of those ideological silos to start getting people to come together
right.
outside of their own groups. So that's a bit of my background, and I'll stop talking because there's a lot of talking.
Here but we are. And yeah, it's, you know, what you've said is it, I think you, it resonates with so many people, the feeling of being an outsider, the feeling of being other. And it's starting to, I hear the stories over and over and over again. And I'm now wondering, like, who is even, what is the norm? Because if so many of us are feeling on the outside, then, you know, there's some sort of mindset shift here that needs to happen. And, you know, what you said, actually, it actually resonates really deeply with me because I didn't grow up in my home country. I didn't grow up in a country. I'm what they call a third culture kid, which is somebody who grows up in a country different from the one they were born in, and they're a citizen of another country. So it was, I moved around a lot my whole life. And it wasn't until I went to college that I started to meet people that were, even though I had lived in many different places, I was still always in a bubble, and the bubble felt safe. And then when I went to college, I started to meet people that were different from me. And I think you're so right that we need to be challenged. We need to be challenging each other. And so that kind of brings me to my question about echo chambers. Echo chambers, they are hard to break out of because we tend to surround ourselves with people that agree with us. It's, you know, politically, socially, we want to hear the same messages being reinforced because it gives us a feeling of belonging. How do you think we can start to listen to more diverse voices?
This is the big question.
The eternal challenge.
my life's mission in one question. So I've done a lot of thinking on this yeah. and it's challenging.
Right.
I think in order to start breaking the echo chamber, we've got to call it as it is. I think a lot of people don't even know what these echo chambers are.
Right.
And I think until we're starting to see things like The Social Dilemma on Netflix and what's happening in our political system, people aren't really understanding how we're self-selecting and choosing viewpoints and communities that make us feel comfortable and seen right. through our own points of view. So right. I think step one, even though it may sound silly, is just to understand more the echo chambers that we exist in.
Right.
And I think that was really helpful for me in looking back on my upbringing, realizing to what extent I was living in an echo chamber and how that's carried throughout my life. So I think that's step number one.
Right.
And number two, I think I do a lot of work with Gen Zers, as you shared already, and we're all on social media.
Yeah.
I know a lot of the world is. And I like to compare the echo chamber to your social media newsfeed.
Right.
So like a Twitter or an Instagram or a Clubhouse or a TikTok, when you follow individuals mm-hmm. on your platform, the algorithm is feeding you similar content because it's trying to match content with what you're interested
exactly.
in to keep you on the app.
Right.
But what we don't realize is for those of us, especially who we're friends with on Facebook or the people we're following on Twitter, we probably follow people from our childhood, people yeah. who we're friends and family with, political figures, thought leaders who we agree with. And that can quickly become an echo chamber because you're only seeing and scrolling through viewpoints that reaffirm your own.
Right.
So this may sound silly, but sometimes it's a game for me. I try to push myself mm-hmm. every month mm-hmm. to follow 5 new accounts
right.
that have a different view than me. It doesn't
right.
have to be on the opposite side of any spectrum. Things are very fluid.
Right.
But if I'm from Kansas, maybe I want to find someone from another country or someone to provide some sort of new experience or perspective that I may have never had exposure to. So I think little things mm-hmm. like reevaluating who we're following and subscribing to on social platforms and then taking that idea into the real world.
Right.
And starting to push yourself into new communities, new platforms, new ecosystems with people who may encourage you to think and grow. I think that's how we can start just the exposure piece.
Right.
Being exposed to new points of view.
Right.
And then, this is a long answer. We can talk about this forever. But I'll say one more thing.
I think absolutely.
The last and final piece is once you can get exposure mm-hmm. to people with new points of view, I think it's all about starting to understand how much more in common you have with someone who you may have othered
right.
than you may have ever previously realized. And in discovering those commonalities, we're more able to listen to each other's diverse viewpoints.
It wasn't a long answer. I think it was absolutely right. What you're saying is that it's like a social media feed. I watched The Social Dilemma and I was a little scared. I'm not going to lie about how much of my beliefs are constantly reinforced. And I've talked about this with my partner. Sometimes I'll say, I keep hearing that America is politically fractured. I keep hearing that the world is politically fractured. But, I see all of this stuff on Instagram and all of the stuff about racism and everyone's agreeing with these. Like, of course, it's your social media feed. Of course, you're getting fed the stuff that you are seeking out, the stuff that you are talking about, the stuff that you believe in. And it's so, so intelligent that there, it can get so detailed. So I think being mindful of that is important. And this sort of segues into kind of what I think, is amazing about The Conversationalist is that your work is so, like, you're working across so many social media platforms. You're on Instagram, you're on YouTube, you're on Clubhouse, you're on your Geneva app. Like, I can barely keep track of 2 platforms. I'm like, how are they doing this? But it's, I'd love to talk a little bit more about this idea of driving social impact through social media. And I think, I don't want to say it's new, but I think especially in the last year since Corona, since the COVID-19 pandemic, since, a lot more social issues became so public, and maybe also because we had the time to listen and pay attention, social media has just become this Gen Z activist platform in many ways. So I'd love to get your thoughts on leveraging social media for this. Because from my perspective, I can't think of a better use of social media than to use it as a platform to amplify people and to encourage dialogue.
I completely agree. However, it can be dangerous at times.
Yes.
But for the most part, social media is the most powerful tool, at least of our generation as we know it. And I'd love to share a statistic. 66% of Gen Z is interested in connecting with someone who thinks differently than they do
right.
under a shared social cause. And so I think this statistic shows the gravity that these platforms have because it can be and serve as that bridge to bring people together, to unite, to take action for these important social causes. And I think it's important to recognize that at the forefront, the reason why social media allows us to create this social change is because these platforms like Instagram and TikTok and Clubhouse, they democratize voice.
Yes.
And it allows every single person to have a platform where I think has had a positive impact in allowing every single young person or person out there to feel like their voices do matter and that they can share about a social cause to their Instagram story or post a video about it on TikTok and feel that other people will listen and be receptive. So I think the power it's had in democratizing voice has been immensely profound.
Right.
But I think at the end of the day, as we're seeing pieces like The Social Dilemma or current conversations like performative activism, mm-hmm. I think it's important to recognize that social media was intended to be the bridge.
Yeah.
And a way to connect with people who you may have never been able to connect with before. But I don't know if social media platforms really intended to be a place for action to be taken. And so I think this is where we find that difficult dialogue surrounding social media slacktivism and whether real change is occurring on the platform. And so with new tools being integrated, if we again are talking about platforms like Instagram, whether it be the donate button or certain cause stickers that you can tag and start a movement, there are some incredible features. But the way I like to think about it is that if we can utilize social media as a bridge to create that momentum, amazing.
Right.
But I think that true social change will require more than a post to your Instagram story. But it's something we're still figuring out.
Yeah.
And I think the power of social media, lastly, has just shown the power of collective voice. And so it's not just you sharing what you believe in, but it shows how the ripple effect can come into play in spreading awareness and getting the word out and taking action. Mm-hmm. But I do think that we have to consider the piece outside of the platform that I think we're starting to lose a little bit.
You know, and I completely agree with you. I remember writing an article about this shortly after the protests broke out in the United States following the sort of the heinous murder of George Floyd. And it was after everyone posted the blackout screen on their Instagram feeds. And there was a lot of conversation being happening about, you know, recognizing racial injustice, calling it out, talking about it. But there was this, my article was sort of trying to look at that in terms of, okay, so you post a blackout screen, now what, right? Like, it doesn't mean racism is solved externally, but it also doesn't mean racism is solved in you or me or, you know, all of us, because we all have grown up in a society that is where some, you know, racism is so entrenched. And so is it an easy way to kind of be let off the hook from examining your own problematic beliefs? I don't know. And so that was, so I think you're completely right in saying that it's a great place to bridge, but we have to be cautious. We have to still keep doing the internal work. We have to still keep actually doing the work, whether it's laws being changed and, you know, spaces being opened up. It's not enough to just say, oh, well, we support XYZ cause, or we are in the camp of women, or, you know, we support Black people in this space. Like, show up and kind of put your money where your mouth is and show up instead of just, you know, putting it up on LinkedIn or Instagram. And so I completely agree with you.
And to add on, because I'm so in agreement with you, Purva, I think
we're in an echo chamber right now.
I know. And I was going to actually say that it's also tricky because I think we do mistake a lot of what we see on social media as reality. Right. But it's important to recognize that even if X amount of people are posting a black square, that's only X percentage of
the total,
you know,
population.
The larger population. Yeah. And I think we also have to remember that we have to give people grace.
Yeah.
There are so many lanes to a movement.
Yeah.
And if someone isn't posting a graphic to their social media story or feed, it doesn't mean that they're not taking action in a different way. Someone who may not be posting might be donating silently, maybe reading, maybe sharing and, you know, sifting through resources and so on and so forth.
Talking to their parents at dinner, challenging their own family members about, you know, having conversations and trying to challenge their beliefs. Yeah.
Retweet. Never felt more seen or heard in that statement. 100%. People are having conversations behind closed doors that we can't even fathom. But I think we're so quick to judge. And sometimes we think that we know the right way to take action. And I think it's important to, again, recognize the collective.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I agree with you. And so this kind of brings me to this idea of unity. And you describe yourself as a unifier, which I love, by the way. I was like, her branding is on point, and it, because it is exactly what you are, and it's perfect. So I've been thinking a lot about this because you're a Zillennial, as you mentioned, but I'm a Millennial, right bang in the middle of Millennial, and you work with a lot of Gen Zers. Well, there is this narrative out there, and I see it all the time, that Millennials and Gen Z can't agree on things. We are kind of, you know, at each other's throats. We're in disagreement over some of the silliest things. And I don't know how true that narrative is because, and I can't speak for the entire millennial generation, but I have a lot of millennial friends. And in my experience and what I've heard is whenever, you know, they spend time with any Gen Zers or any Gen Zers I know, I find that we're mostly in agreement on a lot of things. And so, you know, I kind of love to just kind of unpack this narrative a little bit because I don't necessarily know if it's helpful in kind of bringing us together and working towards a common goal.
And we might be in an echo chamber again, because I completely agree with you. And it's interesting because I think I'm so entrenched in the day-to-day of Generation Z that I actually haven't heard a lot of this friction between Gen Z and millennials. I think typically when we think about intergenerational friction, we think about Generation Z versus the boomers. And so I'm going to be honest, I don't think I'm an expert on this issue, but what I can say is that I think every generation has had misconceptions placed upon them.
Absolutely.
And I think those misconceptions are due to a lack of dialogue.
Right.
And I think at the end of the day, whether it's Gen Z and millennials, whether it's Gen X and millennials or Generation Z and the boomer generation, I think we have to all acknowledge that we've all experienced the world at a different time.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, this might sound crazy, but we all might want to see the same thing happen in our lifetime.
Yeah.
We just have a different way of going about it.
Right.
And I think we get so caught up in judging one another and not sitting down and understanding and respecting and listening to one another's lived experiences to get to that common ground. So I think it's interesting. I think millennials get cast as, you know, the lazy generation or the generation that, you know, isn't putting in the work to do X, Y, and Z, whereas Generation Z is the opposite. They're trying to do too much and they, you know, haven't been able to, like, you know, pay their dues. And so I think it's interesting because at the end of the day, I think the reason that Generation Z is the way it is because of the millennial generation.
Yeah.
I read some statistic that I think 50% of millennials consider themselves to be politically unaffiliated.
Right.
And I think millennials started that trend of starting to reject institutions and messaging that's out there in the world. And so I think Generation Z is adopting that and embracing it, but reinventing it.
Yes.
And Generation Z now is placing their trust back into traditional institutions with the caveat that those institutions represent their morals and their belief systems.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I it's such a shame that there is that friction because one wouldn't exist without the other.
Yeah.
And I think we're constantly following in the footsteps of the generations that precede us and follow us. But Purva, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I absolutely agree with you. And I mean, like we've established, we are in an echo chamber, but it was, so I did a little bit of research and I found that a lot of the things that millennials and Gen Z quote unquote disagree on are very kind of high level superficial things. And I'm going to read some of them out to you because I think you're going to get a kick out of this. Side parts versus middle parts. skinny jeans versus baggy jeans, crying emoji versus skull emoji. And to that, I just want to say, I would love nothing more. It's a Friday night to sit in my skinny jeans, drink a glass of wine with my doggo, watch Harry Potter, and send my friends crying laughter emojis. That is my response to that. But I do think that there are a lot of things that we agree on. And I made a list of some of the things that I have seen Gen Zers and millennials talking a lot about and taking quite seriously. And you touched on one that I would like to kind of delve into a little bit deeper, but we'll get to that. The first one is that climate change is the single biggest issue of our time and that the world, the entire world should be focused on it. The second is that racial injustice is an ongoing problem. The third, and that's the one I'd like to get your thoughts on, is this reduced confidence in traditional institutions. And again, I don't want to speak for the entire millennial generation, but I believe that there is there might be a feeling among millennials of, I don't want to say complete distrust, but a little bit of skepticism when it comes to traditional institutions. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that we graduated in the around the recession, and just as things started to stabilize in our careers, there's now been the second recession. And I think that a lot of the things that happen don't necessarily give us a lot of confidence often that things are changing. So I would love to get your thoughts, because you said that Gen Z is starting to, kind of put the onus back onto institutions a little bit. So, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that a bit more.
Yeah, of course. Purva, I love what you shared. I think the moral of today's episode is that we do have so much more in common than that which divides us, whether right. It's emojis or common values across generations. But let's unpack the institutional piece.
Right.
I think when I hear this trend that millennials started of starting to reject traditional institutions, I start to think about, what do institutions represent? I think institutions group us into categories, whether it be religion, whether it be culture, or education. I think it puts us into boxes.
Yeah.
And I think Generation Z now, as the most diverse generation to date, is rejecting the notion of the box.
Yeah.
I think Generation Z is doing an incredible job of valuing diversity, expecting diversity, but also knowing that they are more than a few things on a list of checkboxes.
Right.
And so I think it's interesting. And I think that's something that Gen Zers and millennials share.
Yeah.
That they've started to place some distrust in these systems that were created to divide us.
Right.
And have now started with Generation Z, starting that rebuilding process, but making sure that their time and their money and their energy are going into institutions that reflect the world that they want to live in.
Right.
So the best example I love to give is that our Gen Zers, like you said, climate change being such a pressing issue of our time, everyone in our community wants to make sure that we're supporting companies and organizations that are building sustainable futures and products.
Right.
So when we think about companies we want to work with down the road, we want to work with the Patagonias of the world and, all other sustainable businesses, mm-hmm. We could name a list, but I think it's the perfect example of how these, I guess, millennials again carved and paved the path for us to follow in order to reject the notion of the box and rebuild it by placing trust into institutions that will honor us as a full person for more than just one identity.
That's amazing. And you're absolutely right. The purpose-driven millennial. I remember when 4 or 5 years ago, there was all this talk about, well, millennials want to work in a place with purpose. And it was a new concept for a lot of, kind of traditional corporations. But it's this idea of identity. And I think Gen Z might be sort of leading the charge on fluid identity, where you can't put them into a box. And I was thinking about this, harking back to our Clubhouse chat. I think one of the questions was, what do the younger generations want in a workplace? And I loved your answer that it's hard to say one thing, because it, you know, yes, diversity, but individuals have different needs and expectations of what they want. And I think maybe looking at people, putting them into boxes is perhaps the perfect way to explain it, that you can't put people into boxes. And so each time you are interviewing someone, each time you are bringing someone on board into your company, you need to think about them as an individual and what will this person need to flourish here, and what is the training and the guidance and the and opportunities that they need for this to be a place that they want to work in. And I think we can agree on a lot of sort of high level things. Like you said, we agree on climate change being such a pressing issue. We agree that we want, you know, institutions to take more accountability for the racial injustice and the gatekeeping and open doors for more people. I think that we agree on many more things than disagree on. And while we spend our time arguing over side parts and middle parts, you know, climate change is happening, people. So let's get back to the issues at hand. But this kind of brings me to the idea of, and I think we talked about this briefly before when we connected, about there being a lot of expectation and pressure on Gen Z's shoulders. And I've heard this time and time again. You know, sometimes my partner and I will say this, we'll say, you know, I have so much faith in Gen Z. They are going to be the generation that is going to save everybody. I've heard friends of mine say that. Anyone who spent time with Gen Z are saying, you know, they think Gen Z is just fine. Gen Z's got a handle on it. That must put a lot of pressure on a generation that is still just finding their place in the world and trying to figure out who they are. I mean, so many, like, the youngest Gen Zers are what, 10 years old or six yeah. years old, something like that.
11 and 12.
Okay. So there you go. So, you know, that person needs to those people just need to live and enjoy being in the world and not be worried about the world's problems. So, you know, I'd love your thoughts on that.
This is something that's come up a lot in my conversations at The Conversationalist. It's interesting because, like you shared, this past election cycle was, for a lot of Gen Zers, their first time voting.
Right.
And, you know, this generation is just starting to enter into the world and starting to understand how to use their voices for good and make an impact. And we see so many incredible youth activists truly redefining what activism means and what it means to take action.
Right.
But I do think, after speaking to a lot of those quote unquote youth activists myself, there is this immense pressure to solve all of the world's problems. And I think the frustration is that in a perfect world, these individuals would just be like any other normal kid.
Right.
Like, I remember speaking to Arielle Geismar, who's a youth activist in the gun violence prevention space.
Right.
And she always shares, you know, I would love to just be a normal student in college and not having to deal with these issues on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. But if not now, when? And if not me, then who?
Right.
And I think, especially as the people who hold traditional seats of power are from older generations, I think there's a lack of accountability at times to get these issues done mm-hmm. and to make change. Yeah. And so this generation feels the world on their shoulders because they don't want their kids and their grandkids to have to experience what they're feeling. Right. And so I think, again, there's this intergenerational disconnect mm-hmm. that is felt on both sides, right? Like you shared, the older generations are like, you know, Gen Z's got it taken care of. I don't have to worry about right. this. They've got it handled. But all Gen Z wants is to be able to come to the table with the people who can make things happen
right.
and find a solution.
Yes.
But I think a lot of older generations, and again, I can't speak for them, but the perception is that those particular individuals don't really believe that Gen Z has what it takes.
Yes.
Yeah. To innovate those solutions. And so again, there's this
right.
this distrust right. that this generation, you know, can even make a difference, even though they're willing and able to do so.
Yeah.
So again, it's, we gotta talk.
We
gotta have these conversations.
Absolutely.
Right?
No, it's exactly, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said that, you know, Gen Z, because you know, they're so young. And maybe millennials now are coming into more seats of power because the oldest millennials are 40 or older, depending on where you kind of draw the line at millennial. But I agree with you that the people that have the power to really affect change, to really make an impact in a political sense, and when it comes to laws, when it comes to policies, those aren't the you know, that's not Gen Z yet. Where I wonder if that might change is that Gen Z, unlike any other generation, including millennials, I would say, have that native, well, especially older millennials are tech natives, and they are so comfortable with technology and being across so many platforms. They are so comfortable with sharing their lives, their thoughts, their day-to-day across multiple platforms. And I think more and more people are starting to see the power of that. And Gen Z is leading the charge on that. And so I think that might be a place for, as you have identified, an opportunity to kind of really show what Gen Z can do. And I think that's, you know, millennials, we grew up with technology, but we didn't grow up with having, you know, we were teenagers by the time cell phones and smartphones and apps and social media became ubiquitous and became a part of our everyday lives. And so, whereas I think Gen Z has just grown up with it since they were kids. And so it's, I think there's this, the power of social media. I mean, I'm a fan of it as a space to, as a way to kind of try and affect change and be that bridge. And I wonder if that's going to be the thing that's going to sort of tip the scales a little bit more in our favor.
I hope so. I mean, there's definitely something special about Generation Z being digital natives.
Yes.
And I almost want to say that happened for a reason.
Yep.
So I'm an optimist, but we've got a long way to go.
Absolutely. Sophie, thank you so much for joining me. It has been, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. It's always such a pleasure to listen to the panels, to join in on Clubhouse, to listen in the Geneva app. I'm a silent participant. I read a lot in the Geneva app. I don't talk as much, but I am just, you know, such a fan of your work and some incredible Gen Zers that are part of the conversationalist community.
Porva, I can't believe our conversation's already over. I feel like we just started talking. That went by so fast. I could talk to you for hours. So thank you for having me. I'm such a fan of all that you do. And thank you for creating a platform to share stories and voices of women. I'm really such a fan and grateful to have been here. So thank you for having me.
No problem. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you want to catch up on all episodes of this podcast or get more great content, head on over to womeninourtown.com or follow the conversation on Instagram and Twitter at womeninourtown.